G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letteru.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me, of course, is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day to you too.
My friend, we're right at the end of the book of Judges.
We're at the end of the book of Judges, yes.
We're in the final.
The grand finale of the mess of the book of Judges.
The grand finale of mess. That's exactly what it is. And I'm none too impressed with this chapter either, but we've got to do it. We have to finish it.
We have to do this one. We have to bear this. And I'm wondering, for example, what we will do when we reach certain chapters in Ezekiel. There are some chapters in Ezekiel that the way things are described are just nasty. So, we'll get there eventually. We might mark those ones as R-rated or something. So, yes, there are places in the Bible that, you know, the description is not very nice. It's kind of difficult, but we're gonna do this anyhow. And so this is how we have to treat this sometimes. When there has to be a discussion over sensitive issues, over things which are maybe people are kind of slightly uncomfortable about them, we still have to open up that box and start dealing with it.
They have to be addressed.
So, yeah, there's a distance in between where we stand on certain things and where they stood on certain things.
But what we have here in Judges chapter 21, and indeed from Judges 19 right through to the end and the culmination of that story in the chapter 21, it's violent. It's just wrong. It's just wrong all around.
The historical writings are violent.
Yeah.
I actually heard someone say about something about this, and I think they're right. The historical writings are violent, but there's a reason they're violent. First of all, it's expressing the issue. If there's no order, there's violence. If there's no one governing the people, there's violence. This is one of the things it's trying to present. But we also have to remember, this is a history of a nation that was relatively new, and they're still trying to figure themselves out. If I would take the history of any other nation in this area, it would still be very, very violent as well. You know, for example, it mentions in the book of Numbers that, you know, the king Sihon took over the city of Heshbon. It doesn't tell you that probably what he did is he went in war and killed a lot of people on the way. There were many warlords in this area. There were many battles, and nations that did not have, or beginning nations or peoples that did not have a governing system, had the problem where there was no law, so people were killing one another left, right, and center. So what you have here in the Bible is just one nation out of dozens that were going through very similar processes. The difference is here that they're at war, as we mentioned last time. They're at war, but they're still calling Benjamin their brother.
That's right.
But the Bible, basically, this is criticism. The Bible is criticizing this pattern of behavior.
And as we left off in chapter 20 last week, of course, the men of Israel, they destroyed Benjamin, leaving all but the women, the children, everyone, as far as we understand, leaving all but 600 men who escaped to Rimon.
Yeah, and actually mentions here, we already mentioned the Sela Rimon, the cliff or the rock of Rimon. It actually says here an interesting thing. It says, Vayifnu, and they turned, Vayanusu, and they fled, Hamidbara, to the desert, El Sela HaRimon, to a place called the Sela of Rimon, the cliff of Rimon. And it uses interesting language, Vayoleluhu b'mesilot. So Vayoleluhu is from the root of alal, which is usually a word, if, for example, we open up Deuteronomy in chapter, I think it's like 23, 24, and actually look it up specifically, but not really important. It mentions the issue of, for example, if you pick your grapes and you have little grapes left, like either single grapes or a small vine that's insignificant, don't trim it. Don't go back to trim the little bits and pieces.
Don't go over
there.
It again.
Go pick, exactly. Pick the main ones, pick the big ones, pick the ones you need. If there's anything, little bits here or there, or a small piece with like four or five of them there, something, leave them for the poor. But he calls it olelot. He calls it olelot. Now, we also had the word olelot again. So those are called olelot, those single little bits and pieces there. Then we have olelot again as we have that with Gideon. I think it was Gideon where he says it's Gideon. He says when he's attacked by the other tribesmen, and he turns to him and says, the grapes of the olelot of Ephraim are better than the batzir of Aviezer. And he's basically referencing to that whatever you leave after you do your vine picking is way better than what we do when we pick our big ones, our important ones, etc.
Sure.
And then here, what's interesting is that it gives us kind of a very, very interesting description that they're chasing them down and then they're cutting them down one after the other. It's not as if it's like one big war. They're chasing them down. The ones that become weak while running, it's basically leaving a trail of
destruction.
It's a trail of destruction, a trail of bodies for miles and miles. Like every couple of feet, you'll see a body. It's not as if you come to a place and there's carnage there and there's a battlefield and everything. It's just the whole way, all the way to Sela HaRimon, there's over 4,000 bodies all the way there.
Mm.
It's like, you know, you would think that, okay, they're running away. Let's chase them down. And no, they were going out of their way to kill as many as possible.
Absolute carnage.
So even if it's one guy, hiding somewhere, they killed him. They chased him down.
Mm.
And just think about it. They were doing something, as we mentioned last time, was horrendous. There's no proof that we in Torah that you had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But they anyhow did it, and it's being criticized. This is extremely violent, you know. Because usually in wars, it was that, you know, if someone fled, you chase down the bulk. But if a few scattered there and there, you still chase down the bulk. You don't chase down one guy who ran over there. You know, unless you have a bowman who can shoot him down, you just leave him alone. You know, unless there's a reason to shoot the guy down. He's an officer, he can reorganize the army or something, then you shoot a guy like that down. But here, this is a people's army. There's nothing. There's no officers, there's nothing.
So this is where we leave it. I mean, this is where we left off, rather, in chapter 20. So 21 picks up from there, obviously. It begins like this. It says, "Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mitzvah, saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. And then the people came to Bethel and remained there before God until evening. They lifted up their voices, they wept bitterly and said, oh, Yehovah, God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel, that today there should be one less or one missing tribe in Israel?" So it seems like at the end of it, Yoel, they've sort of looked around and realized what has happened. They've sort of had a sober moment, so to speak, and gone, what have we done?
So there's a few things. What's very interesting here is, first of all, the act of taking the oath was done in Mitzvah, which means it was done before they actually went to war, which is a bit important.
Which is new information. Now, I mean, we know that they gathered together as one man, but we don't know about this oath, and there's more information to come regarding that.
So now we're starting the second stage of the story, but we have to introduce... This verse is basically an introduction to the actual storyline we're about to deal with.
We had
the war itself, and we mentioned, oh, they met up in Mitzvah, and they gave us a story, a very detailed account of what happened. And now there's another detail here. There's another thing. So what we see here is that, you know, they presumed before they went to war, they didn't really know 100% what's going to happen, but they wanted to punish the tribe of Benjamin. So they said, no one's going to let the daughters marry. If there's any survivors, or if we're able to defeat them, they still want to punish them in a certain way. They, even if they get a hold of who did it, and the war ends very, very quickly, there's a certain element of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth here. People from the tribe of Benjamin raped someone's wife, happens to be someone's daughter as well, then we're going to punish them an eye for an eye, for a tooth. They're not going to be able to marry anyone outside of their own tribe.
And so this was the oath that they took. This is an oath they took before God and cannot be taken back.
Exactly. And as we already established several times, that oaths cannot be undone. The moment you say something, that's it.
Because,
for example, we're about to reach what's rabbinically called Rosh Hashanah. By people hearing this recording, will be after. But there's a Jewish custom, and I think I spoke about this when we did the recording about Yom Teruah, that there's a custom to annul oaths, and it's called Kol Nidre, and there's also a thing called Hatarat Nedarim, the undoing Hatara is because of the oath, or the pledge is actually like a tie. You're bonding yourself to something. So we call it the unbonding or untying of such a thing. And there's a custom to say, oh, you took an oath, oh, there's a way out of it. But we don't see that in the Bible. This is the second case we have in the Book of Judges, where someone takes an oath and there's no way of undoing it. Now, So the first verse is just an introduction to the whole storyline, and they go to Bet-El. So they're done with the war. As we said, it could be that the temple was moved to Bet-El, or at least the main parts of the temple moved to Bet-El. Mm-hmm. So there's an ability to communicate with God in a place which was strategically easier for the battle itself.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're banging their heads on the wall going like, why?
What just happened? And it goes on. So it was on the next morning that the people rose early. They built an altar there as if there wasn't already one. It seems like they built another one and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, "Who is there among the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly of Jehovah? For they had made a great oath." I've got a great oath is what they made concerning anyone who had not come up to Jehovah at mitzvah, saying, "He shall surely be put to death." Now stop there. What's that about? I mean, come on. What? And you know what this reminds me of? This seems like to me a grand scale, Yoel, a grand scale of what we read about earlier in Judges in the vow of Jephthah.
Yephthah took an oath to win the battle. Here it's a slightly different thing. Here they took an oath as a decision making, as a decision which was made. What will be done when we defeat them?
No. This is before. They say anyone who does not come, anyone who doesn't come up to fight in this battle against Benjamin.
No, that's a way of bending people's arms behind their back, saying if you don't come, we'll kill you.
We'll kill you.
Saul does the same thing. Saul does something very similar. When he goes out to war for the first time, he takes an ox, carves it into pieces, and said, if anyone doesn't show up, this is what I'll do to their cattle.
It's a way of enforcing it. There's a lot of parallels in this chapter in regards to that, and that's 1 Samuel chapter 11. We're going to go there, and I'm going to read a little bit of that a little bit later on because there's quite a few parallels, interestingly. But
there were some rabbis who tried to create parallels as well, but we'll touch on that as well when we go there. But there's some parallels that don't work because of issue of timeline and stuff like that. But yeah, so there's a few similarities as well.
Some similarities, and,
It says here in Hebrew, Hashvua Hagedola. It's a term, the great oath, and it uses definite article in both of them, which is just a situation of making something definite. If you have an adjective, then you can certain type of adjectives will receive a definite article as well, because the moment there's a definite article, it's a different term. Mm-hmm. But here it's the great oath, which means historically people remembered this thing called. People remember this thing called the Great Oath, that the entire nation, because it's very rare that it's done. The only times you really have oaths like this is when there's a decision to make to return to Torah and stuff like that. But this is unusual. This is a great oath about something completely different. So it's the Great Oath. It might have been something everyone knew of.
The Great Oath is anyone who doesn't come up and participate, basically, he shall be surely be put to death. And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for the wives of those who remain? And this is, it almost makes me angry reading this, because they killed all their wives. They killed all the people in the town. They didn't have to do that. Why did they do that? We don't really understand. I mean, it's not as if it's... I mean, did it have to be carried that far? In fact, as you mentioned and we mentioned last week, there's no precedent for the action that they took. There's no Torah to say this is what you shall do if something like this happens. They took it upon themselves. They knocked everyone off. And now they're moaning about it, saying, oh, we killed all their wives. Now they don't have any wives. And now Benjamin, our brother, will die out and he won't have anyone to inherit. And so... So they're saying one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain? And remember, there's 600 that have remained. Seeing we have sworn by Jehovah that we will not give them our daughters as wives. And they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to mitzvah to the Lord? And in fact, no one had come from the camp of... Now, is this... Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
So it's called Yavesh Gilad. We actually hear that we bump into them again later on. Brothers of Yavesh Gilad, hundreds of years later, with Nahash, the king of Ammon.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's 1 Samuel chapter 11.
Yeah, so we have this again. What's very interesting here is Vayomur mi echad mishivtei Yisrael. So mi usually means who, but you can maybe explain this as saying is there anyone that has not come up from the tribes of Israel?
Mm-hmm.
So it's another way of looking at it. Sometimes it's kind of funny. Sometimes you'll have a certain use of words, and you would think, oh, you just automatically translate it this way. And then when you actually look at it, when you look at the context, you realize, oh, it's just using this word. It's using a word that usually means this, but here in this context, it means something else. Because we have to remember, Hebrew has less words than, say, English. So certain words are used over and over again to express different things. So we can say, maybe, based on the context here, maybe it can mean not who is, but is there anyone that has not shown up?
It reiterates in verse 9, for when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilad was there. And so the congregation sent out their 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, look at this, Yoel. They commanded them, saying, go and strike the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilad with the edge of the sword, including the women and the children, and this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who's known a man intimately. So they found among the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilad 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Now,
wasn't the camp in Bethel? Again,
yeah,
there's confusion here. There's some kind of mess going on here that someone's trying to figure out. Because, again, we mentioned this whole thing. They built an altar in Bethel, but as far as we know, the temple's in Shiloh. And now they're in Shiloh again. Did this move the camp back? I mean, what exactly is going on here?
Is there a possibility that certain things were observed at Shiloh and certain things, you know, might have been... Certain duties may have taken place at Bethel. Is
so
it possible
again,
because we read about a great feast, and we also read about that in 1 Samuel as well, the great feast at Shiloh.
So again, we mentioned several things. We mentioned this in the past as well, that, you know, we mentioned about Jeroboam regarding the issue why he chose Bethel and Dan,
mm-hmm.
because these were holy sites to begin with.
Mm.
And it could be that Bethel was another, because, you know, Jacob says in the book of Genesis, this will be a house of God,
mm-hmm.
and it's said that way deliberately, and it raises a lot of other questions that this is not the place to deal with. But it seems that it could be, it's plausible that in Bethel there was another some kind of a temple, which brings us back to, for example, remember we did about Joshua, the last chapters of Joshua, we spoke about this temple in Shechem,
mm.
and what it seems is that if we take, for example, the approach of saying when they entered the land, one place was chosen, that was it. But we see in different places evidence that's not what was done. Mm. So as long as there was a tabernacle and it was being moved around, as long as it was still in some kind of a tabernacle, that was the place that God chose, and you have to bring your sacrifices over there.
Mm.
But because it's not really permanent, then you can do a sacrifice anyway. This is a very, very complex subject that the answers in some of them are unclear.
Mm.
But there are elements where you see, just for example, you know, if we take the approach in research, they say, oh, the book of Deuteronomy expresses something which is a latter mindset. This is how they explain it. I don't agree with this, but they say it's a latter mindset. It says, oh, there's only a temple. They were trying to force everyone to this one temple place. Well, read the Torah, and this is what they say. Read the Torah doesn't tell you have to choose one place. It was a latter idea. Now, I don't agree with that because I as a believer in the Torah, say it's all, you know, together, and it's all works together, and everything has to make sense. And what it looks like is that people did not perceive this idea of a one place. God was basically everywhere. God was anywhere that he said, anywhere you call to him, anywhere that you build an altar in his name, he will be there. He's not limited to one place.
Mm.
And we see kind of a bit of a friction in between, say, what happens after the Ten Commandments, where he says, you know, anywhere that I will call by my name, I will come and bless you. And some, you know, what do you mean he calls by his name? I mean, unless a prophet shows up and vocalizes that God calls by his name, it's really us calling his name.
Mm.
So you can explain that as saying that's a place that he chooses. And it could be, and again, this is an early stage. This is the times of Pinchas. So it raises a question. When they entered the land, did they really have an established place? And the answer is probably no. And this is why Joshua had this place in Shechem. There's a place in Shiloh, which might have been where the main tabernacle was. But there's another place in Bet El. And there might have been numerous places all around the land. But when the temple, Jerusalem, was chosen, that's when we start hearing the criticism of building temples and building altars in different places. Mm-hmm. Because it uses the word high places, bamot, or bama as a single. Mm. But it's probably using that word to say these are illegitimate places of worship. But these might have been only places of worship to the God of Israel. And an example of that is very interesting, is that there were two altars discovered in the south part of Israel. One altar had a pattern of a snake all around it. That altar was found smashed. I think that's the altar of Arad, from Tel Arad. And then the altar from Tel Be'er Sheva was found taken apart. It wasn't smashed. It was actually taken apart to its different parts and put aside. Now, there are issues with how these altars were built. These were carved stone and everything, so it shows it doesn't 100%. But it wasn't 100% according to the laws of Torah. But there was an interesting thing that one of the archaeologists pointed out, is that it's interesting that this altar with the snake around it was smashed, which means it was probably made for idolatry. Told you
idolatry.
The difficulty. Remember, we mentioned this idolatry and adultery. They're confusing when you say it in English, and they might have spoken English at the time. This is why they confuse adultery with idolatry. But still, and he said that the altar which was dismantled was probably part of a temple of the God of Israel. And it says, that's a prophecy in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. So they say this might have been an altar to the God of Israel. So it seems that King Solomon built a temple, and we'll talk about this more in detail when we get into the Book of Kings, but it seems that King Solomon built a temple, but people were still in the mentality of there's no one central place of religion. We can build a temple anywhere. Mm. And this is probably what we're seeing here. Before the establishment of one place, anything was legitimate. You can build an altar in your backyard and sacrifice. And we see that. Avshalom says he has an oath he has to fulfill in Hebron. Mm-hmm. Though he was lying, but that was something legitimate. King David said, I must flee to my house because we have a family celebration. Mm. But it seems that, you know, it kind of looks as if they're doing something with sacrifice. Saul, when he meets up with Samuel, they have a sacrificial thing. Unless you want to say Huy Varichet Zevach, which means Zevach, because initially the word Zevach usually means something which is a sacrifice, but there's a point where there's a bit of confusion in how these words are used, because Shachat and Zevach, Shachat is usually for slaughtering for everyday meat, and Zevach is usually for sacrifice, and the word Shachat at one point kind of like vanishes and we see less and less of it, and the word Zevach comes into play. But it looks as if this is also a sacrifice, and this is done by the prophet Samuel. Saul, before he goes out to war, does a sacrifice, and Saul and Samuel tells him off for it. There's an altar in Gibeon, which King Solomon goes to, and we have all these different places, and it looks as if they're all legitimate. And this is probably what we're seeing here. It was legitimate, but when the Temple of Jerusalem was chosen, the prophet said, "These from now on, all these rest of the places are high places." And we even see this criticism in the Book of Kings, where you say King Solomon still sacrificed, and the people still sacrificing at the high places. Only difference is King Solomon also built altars for other deities, for pagan gods. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about other things which were going on. And that might explain what we're seeing here. There's a place in Bet El, there's a place in Dan, there's a place here, there's a place in Shiloh, and the place of that. Because, you know, there's no order here yet. But it raises a question, what was the function of the tabernacle at the time? Was this actually wrong, and they just didn't understand it was wrong, or was it okay? And a tabernacle was mostly done for the official things, and the only sacrifices you can bring in your backyard altar were very, very specific sacrifices. But then when you have to do the Passover or the ritual sacrifices of every feast and the daily sacrifice and everything, that has to be done in the tabernacle. That might be it. That might be it. And these again, are these are questions that are dealt with by researchers, by Jewish scholars, by rabbinic scholars, by everyone, and it developed a lot of strange. Some of them developed a lot of strange things. For example, there was a Karaite group that refused to eat meat because they said the only meat we're allowed to eat is sacrificial meat. That's the conflict about the issue of what Leviticus talks about, because we have a place in Leviticus, and then there's a place in Deuteronomy, and we're going many, many different directions, but very, very quickly. I posted something about the issue of chelev, which is the forbidden fats, and there was someone who sent me saying, oh, but I heard someone say it's only from sacrifices, and therefore we can eat these fats. I'm not surprised they said this, because in Leviticus, the mindset of Leviticus is the only meat you're allowed to eat is sacrificial meat. Mm-hmm. But then in Deuteronomy, that prohibition is removed, and you're allowed to eat any meat. You're allowed to eat all meats, but the prohibition of the fats is still standing. And there's a lot of these little details you have to work on. So, you know, this is why I'm going to start working on my PhD very, very soon, because there's a lot of these little things that we have to work on.
You could write a volume of books on this topic.
There are volumes of books about these topics. Yeah, there's loads and loads of books about these things. And loads and loads of discussion. I have a book here in my library that deals only on chapters 17, 18, and 19 of Leviticus, and this is like a 400-page book, and he deals only with those three chapters for pages and pages and pages, dissecting this from different directions.
Well, if any listeners have any opinion on the matter, by all means, share them in the comments. But speaking of, you mentioned Saul, you mentioned Samuel, you mentioned snakes, I may as well read 1 Samuel chapter 11 now, because there are some parallels, as we mentioned. And it says, then Nahash. Is it Nahash?
Nahash, yeah.
And that means?
Snake.
Snake. The Ammonites came up
He was a snake.
He was a snake. And encamped against Yabesh.
This is very funny. There's a very funny phonetic thing. His name is Nahash. And what does the snake do?
Nahash, yeah.
There's a lot of these little games. They say that sometimes... I can't remember exactly what the name of the word I'm looking for, but it's a phonetic thing that when something produces a certain sound, it produces its actual name. And I can't remember its name now, but there's a specific term for that. Mm. Where if a specific sound plays on is played into the name of something. So for example, the word for bottle in Hebrew is bakbuk. Now if you do it with a bottle, bakbuk, same thing. It's what's called bakbuk. Nachash, the Nachash goes Nachash, you know.
Sure.
And it's actually an official term for it. It's kind of funny because all these terms are usually something Latin or Greek, so and they don't really mean they don't mean anything to us. For example, as Hebrew speakers, we actually one of the things I do a lot when I teach Hebrew is I can give the official term, but I prefer to use something the closest term to what it actually means. So we, for example, call this thing called a mitzlol from the word slil, which means a sound. Mm-hmm. So basically, all going off through these rabbit trails, basically the name Nachash, which means snake, which is kind of funny for someone to be mentioned like this. Maybe when he was born, there was a hiss or something. So his father said, oh, there's a hiss of a snake. We're going to call our son Snake. And by the way, that actually makes sense. The stuff like that actually happens sometimes. Sure. There's a guy in Chronicles called Yabetz. And it says because his mother bore him Be'etzev. So Yabetz, Etzev, and Etzev is sorrow. And he just used the same sound to produce... the name, his name. It's like the name Noah. And it says Zeyenachamenu, the Noach and Menachem. It's very, very close. So this might explain why a father would call his son Snake.
Sure. And so here he is, and he's an Ammonite, right, which is the descendant of Lot. And came up and encamped against Gabesh Gilad. I mean, these guys cop a lot, right? And it seems like even though Israel went and slaughtered them for, I think, is a debatable reason. They went and slaughtered them, and the women and children and all, and so on and so forth. Either it was resettled by other people, or there were some survivors. In any case, the place still existed many, many years later. And all the men of Yabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us, and we will serve you. So they're kind of saying, okay, so, you know, hey, we surrender. You guys are obviously going to kick our butts, so let's make a covenant together, and we'll just be your servants. But Nahash wouldn't have it. He said, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may pull out all your right eyes and bring reproach on Yisrael. And the elders of Yabesh said to him, hold off 7 days that we may send messages to all territory of Yisrael, and then if there's no one to save us, we will come out to you. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Shaul, Saul, and told the news in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted their voices and wept. And now there was Shaul coming behind the herd from the field, and Shaul said, what troubles the people? Why do they weep? And so they told him the words of the men of Yabesh, and the Spirit of God came upon Shaul, and when he heard about this, and his anger was greatly aroused, so he took a yoke of oxen and cut them into pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Yisrael by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not go out with Shaul and Shmuel, Samuel, to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen. And the fear of Jehovah fell upon the people, and they came out with one consent. So there's a couple of things.
There's a lot of things here. You're right. Yeah, there's a lot of things here.
There's the cutting up of, I mean, obviously it's not a concubine, it's the cutting up of an oxen and sending it, you know, to all the pieces to all the around Israel, and it serves as some sort of object lesson. There's also the people coming together with one consent, you know, as we read before, people come together with as one man in chapter 20 of Judges. And there's also the picking on the people of Yabesh Gilead.
So it's a very interesting thing, this parallel.
Yeah. And I mean, I know in Judges chapter 20, there were 400,000 that came together. In this case, in verse 8,
300,000.
Yeah.
And 30,000 from Judah.
So we're still talking about huge numbers. And so.
Yeah, we're still dealing with huge numbers here.
So he delivers them anyhow, and it's all good. Now, interestingly, before we get off that, Yoel, it's worth also pointing out that the people of Yabesh Gilead, they do appear again at the end of 1 Samuel 31.
They take care of his body.
They take care of
because they basically owe him one.
They do. They owe him one because he saved all their right eyes, right?
Yeah, and then we have, by the way, in the end of this chapter, we have they go to Gilgal and they sacrifice his sacrifices there.
True.
So there's a lot of the sacrificing going on outside of the tabernacle.
Yeah. But I'm really upset for these guys because, you know, as you and I spoke last week, right, maybe they were smart and they got together and they said, hey, all the Israelites are getting together. They're going to go together because some Levite and his concubine, something happened and there were men there that got angry and he cut her up and he said, well, that doesn't make sense to us, so we're not going to go and get involved in this. This sounds crazy. And maybe they all stayed at home and thought, you know, let's just stay out of this one because it's kind of crazy. And, you know, maybe, who knows? Maybe that's why, you know, I don't know. But in any case, whatever it was, there was a great oath concerning anyone who didn't come, and so they went and killed them all. What's with that? Not only did they kill them all, they took the virgins after slaughtering their brothers and sisters and mother and father and so on and so forth. They took them and said, now you're going to go and be Benjamin's wives, the people we went and destroyed and almost pretty much wiped out. Now you're going to go and be their wives. I just find it hard to wrap my brain around this. You want to kind of help me out here?
It doesn't make sense. It does not make sense, but they're trying to save the tribe, so they're playing. I think this is where the Jewish mind comes into play a bit. They're finding these loopholes to find a way of helping.
Yeah, and they're playing
these tricks and games, and you know, let's push it somewhere through there. We're going to find a loophole and get it through.
Because on the one hand,
they took an oath. On the other hand, they don't want this tribe to perish.
So let's read about one of these loopholes, because you're absolutely right. They find a loophole. They do make an oath, and they have to fulfill it. But we see in just the next couple of verses, there is a loophole that they kind of put into play here. And it says in 13, the whole congregation sent words to the children of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimon. They announced peace to them. Don't worry about it. Don't worry. It's all right, you know, peace now.
They woke up with a white flag saying, peace on you, we're not here to kill you anymore, it's okay.
Yeah, yes.
They were hiding there. They literally went and they found refuge there.
Sure.
And they hid there. They probably were very worried, seriously concerned that someone would show up one day and finish the job.
So they're
trying to survive there. Yeah, they're surviving there. There's a very, very small group. All you have to do is surround the place and charge and kill, and that's it.
Yeah. Or so they walk up to them. Surround the place and starve them out. I mean, it wouldn't have been that hard. But in any case, they go to Benjamin. They say, "Don't worry about it. By the way, here's a bunch of women that we stole for you, that we kidnapped." And they gave them the women whom they had saved alive, the women of Yabesh Gilead. And yet there was not enough, right? Because we've got 400 women, we've got 600 guys, we've got 200 guys that are going, "Hey, I don't have a wife." And the people grieved for Benjamin because Yehovah had made it says Yehovah had made a void in the tribes of Israel.
So that goes back to what we said last time, that God was given these vague answers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also probably a recognition of punishment. They recognize that this wasn't by chance, this was punishment. They were being punished about something.
Verse 35 of chapter 20 that says, Yehovah defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites, all these through the sword. And so there's the corresponding verse. And yet, this is the claim in 21:15. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What do we do with the wives? You know, the guys that don't have wives. What are we going to do? You know, because the women of Benjamin have been destroyed." And they said, "Well, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel." However,
inheritance here probably means someone who will be able to inherit, meaning a continuation.
Yep, absolutely. "And we cannot give them the wives from our own daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn, and once again, this is the third time, cursed be anyone who gives a wife to Benjamin." And so they said, and here's the loophole that you were talking about, they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of Yehovah in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebona." Now,
so it's kind of funny. Why is it giving all these details of exactly where it is? This should be a famous place.
Yeah.
And it could be that it wasn't that famous at the time. But then there's a question. So why is there a feast to God there? Why is it specifically a feast there? So it could be that there was some kind of a temple there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that bothers a lot of the commentators is, what is this feast? No one knows what it is.
This is the question, because is it one of the feasts of Leviticus 23?
So some people say it might be one of those feasts. It might be a special feast, an extra feast that they had, which was specifically to the people of Shiloh. They had some kind of a celebration, because the problem is it's called the Feast of God.
Yes.
So it's actually in a certain form. So it's in the construct. So it has to be something very, very specific. Also, the word chag is from the word chagag, which means to encircle. So it's something which shows up every year.
Right.
So but it doesn't prove this is one from Leviticus, but it does raise a few eyebrows. So some people say that it could be that by this time there was some kind of a distance from what the Torah was saying, but that's very strange, very vague, because it's too early for that to happen. Mm. Pinchas is still alive. This is a few decades after they entered the land. So a lot of people say it might be a special feast that was only for Shiloh. It was some city celebration and had nothing to do with the laws of the Torah. Because there's no prohibition of having a celebration. For example, I don't know, birthday. You can celebrate your birthday. I don't think there's anything wrong with celebrating birthdays.
Sure.
Though I have heard some people claim it's forbidden, but I don't see any reason. I can't find any reason why it's forbidden. We do find that Pharaoh celebrated his birthday, but that means absolutely nothing to us. I don't see anything there that says anything about. But for example, celebrate
everyone
that
knew how old they were.
Yeah. So I think that. Oh, no, everyone. There are people who were born and then no one knows when it was.
Sure.
You know, there's a woman here in Israel, an Arab woman, who was born somewhere in 1888 or something like that, or 1889, but she has no idea when. They know the year she was born at.
Okay.
So her family said, for example, her family celebrates her birthday at the end of every Gregorian year. Basically, on the 31st of December, they celebrate her birthday because they have no idea when she was actually born. Now, so here it could be that there was a Thanksgiving celebration or something, and it was referred to as a celebration of God. But because it uses the term of Chag Hashem, Chag Adonai, it still kind of like bugs me in the back of my head that it might be something to do with one of the celebrations of Torah.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, it's a celebration in the summer because they go and dance in the vineyards. So now, we don't now, have tell me about now, a what celebration is in the summer.
You've already trampled down some grapes, right, and made some wine, but what is the situation now? Are the grapes over and out, or are there still grapes being collected? What's happening?
It's the end of it, really, the grapes. By the end of August, beginning of September, it starts dwindling. And really the time, one of the strange things that people don't live in a world where the agriculture is still very strong, is that, for example, in the U.S., you can find certain fruits and vegetables all the time. Mm-hmm. Or when you, for example, live in Europe, I mean, Europe, for example, in certain parts of Europe, you can't really grow that much. There's certain plantations that can, you know, plants that can grow in cold weather and stuff like apples and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But some things won't grow.
So the question has to be asked, is this, I mean, they go dancing in the vineyards. I mean, it goes on to say, therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, every man, and catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh. Then, I mean, they're kidnapping the women, right? Then go to the land.
Kidnapping the women, yeah.
But now, so it mentions the vineyards. So if, I mean, hypothetically, so, I mean, so obviously it's seasonal.
It's seasonal. Obviously it's not during the winter.
So do you think, I mean, let's say Passover, for example. You go and dance in the vineyards at Passover, and all the vines are skeletons, right? There's nothing on
it. There's nothing. The leaves are only starting to come out. Yeah, so what's the point of dancing among these funny little gray, brown stems? There's no point. What it looks like is that there's different interpretations. Some people say, for example, it might be some kind of a wine celebration.
Sure.
That now they're about to harvest the grapes, and they're going to produce wine. So it used to be like that. When harvest was done, it was a celebration. It wasn't just,
we're being blessed. Now harvest is pretty much done now, I mean, is what you're saying.
So you can say this is, for example, Sukkot. It might be Sukkot because that's the celebration of the finish of the harvest. It could be Shavuot, though Shavuot is a bit too early for grapes. Because you have to explain why, if it had nothing to do with the grapes, if it has nothing to do with the vine, why are they dancing near the vine? Why are they in that area? Why does it say the mention that they're
dancing? Would there be some kind of celebration for Yom Teruah?
So there's an opinion that might say this has to do with Elkanah, the father of Shmuel, that he used to go every year. So some commentators want to say he used to go during, he went an extra fourth time, because the Torah commands three. He went a fourth time to during Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah, to Shiloh, and this might have been it as well. He made a big fuss out of it, so he turned to the celebration of Yom Teruah. It wasn't just a day where he made noise. He was the one who pushed the whole idea. But this is way before Elkanah either. So there's an interpretation, for example, in the Mishnah that says that this was the 15th of Av, and it was considered to be a happy day. There's another one, because the Mishnah says something interesting. It says, "Lo ayu yamim tovim Yisrael kitu be'av u'yom kippurim sheben benot Yisrael yotzot yotzot b'klei lavan she'ulim." This is a thing I memorized. "Klei lavan she'ulim v'cholot b'karamim." So they actually say that it might have been the 15th of Av, or even Yom Kippur. Because they say that there was a tradition amongst the Israelites, amongst Jews, that on the days of Tu Be'av and Yom Kippur, the girls of Israel would dress in white and celebrate in the vineyards. Now, I have difficulty saying that you know, they danced in the vineyards during Yom Kippur, but as we did in the recording we did last year about Yom Kippur, it's not a sad day, it should be a happy day. But it could be that there was a special day, always held by the people of Israel, that 15th of Av, which is the peak of the summer, which is the peak of when you harvest the grapes, is the celebration day. And that might have been a day when people would go, and that's when young men would pick their bride and go with that and say, I want that one. Because that's how they used to pick wives. You know, they just go, that one. And then the father sees her, checks who she is, and starts negotiating with it. They start negotiating with her father. Yeah. So this might have been it. So my strong inclination is to say it was the 15th of Av because it's summertime. It works with the vineyard. Well, there is a Jewish tradition. That's a time when people went, when women, virgins specifically, would go celebrate, and it might have been a way where they found a husband, because there were several ways, either the well or the parents being know each other, or maybe this as well. So it might have been a special celebration. Now, also, I don't know if anyone's ever been in the area of Shiloh. The area of Shiloh has some of the best vineyards I've ever seen.
Truly. Nice.
I've been there many, many times. I actually almost slept one day on the junction down there because I was catching rides in the middle of the night. There was no way of doing it. So a friend of mine almost decided that we'll take watches. One will sleep, the other will be awake, and then we'll change. but they have some of the best vineyards. And let me tell you a secret that no one wants to admit. A lot of the wine, there's a lot of wine out there that goes to Europe, which the Europeans are trying to boycott, that actually comes from that valley. They produce certain types of wine. There's a winery we went to in Rechelim, which is just after the Valley of Shiloh, and they have amazing wine there. They produce wines that usually don't have in Israel, and wines they have to bring in. And you know, if you ever visit Israel, I suggest going to that vineyard. Go to that winery. They have amazing wines.
I am demanding that. Well, no, when we get there, it's going to be the first couple of weeks of March. And again, there's not going to be a lot on the trees, but obviously they're going to have some bottled away, and I'm looking forward to sampling some of that, Yoel. We have to have an opportunity,
We have to grab a hold of Keith
and demand. We want to go to the vineyards.
So there are some amazing vineyards. There's a vineyard, for example, that my wife's father helped. How do I know what to do with wine? He told me. Uh-huh. He also told the owner of a vineyard in Gush Etzion. He taught him a whole bunch of stuff, and the guy is succeeding based on his recipes. And he gives my father-in-law credit when he has the opportunity. We can take you there. There's actually a book. There's an interesting book called "Traveling Through Wine in Israel" or something like that. It goes all the different vineyards in Israel, and we have very, very, very high quality wine. We have the wines, for example, of Ramat HaGolan, of the Golan Heights, which has a certain. They have some amazing wines. The Golan Heights wineries. There's wineries in Judea and Samaria which are outstanding. There's a winery in Binyamina. There's a winery in Barkan, which is West Samaria. And it's very, very high quality. I've never heard of a bottle that sells more than a couple hundred shekels, but there's a lot of them that won golden medals in international competitions.
Nice.
The soil in this area, it's very interesting. The soil in this area, for example, of Judea and Gush Etzion, where I live, not the side I live at, the other side. I live in the desert side. The other side, the soil there is amazing for wine, amazing for grapes.
Brilliant.
And some of the olive oil we have here in Israel. I mean, I remember growing up north in Israel, huge fields of olive, huge olive tree fields. And we have very, very high quality, international level quality.
Just a reminder to the listeners that there is an opportunity to join the tour, the 3Ts tour. You'll find a link on the right-hand side of truthtoyou.org, the Israeli flag. If you click on that, it will take you to the details where you can join myself, Keith Johnson, Yoel, and others. We're going to be going on a tour through Israel, and so if you'd like to take part in that, the bus is filling up, but there may be space, so be quick. So there's also Elkanah. So it says in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 3, that he went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to Jehovah of hosts in Shiloh. And there's another reference to that, potentially what may be the same feast day. But in any case, Yoel, they steal the women. And this is the loophole, because they say, look, Benjamin, you go, lie in wait. When they come out dancing in the vineyard, just nick them. Just grab the one you like and run off, and you only need 200, and then you're set, all right? And then it shall be when their fathers or their brothers come to us and complain, hey, where's my sister? Where's my daughter? That we will say to them, hey, be kind to them for our sakes. What? We almost just wiped them out. This cost us 40,000 soldiers, and then we wiped out, 25,000 of their soldiers. But now you're saying, just be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war, for it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. And what they're saying is, we made an oath that we would not give our daughters to Benjamin. Well, you didn't. You didn't give your... We stole them. Mm-hmm. Well, they stole them. Exactly. Benjamin stole them, and therefore...
That's the loophole. We said we're not going to give. We're not going to give, but if they take... We're not going to stop them. So there's like this little loophole there in how to deal with it.
What is that about? And I mean, there's a lot of that, right?
Well, again, in Judaism, we do it all the time, but you do it in legal systems all the time as well. A lot of legal systems around the world, how do you get someone off the hook of something? You find a loophole.
Yeah, that's it. And so the children of Benjamin did so. They nicked 200 women, as far as we know. They took enough wives for the number of those who danced, whom they kidnapped, Yoel, I think, is probably. But now, listen, this is the thing. Is there not? Don't I remember reading about a Torah against kidnapping?
It's stealing a person and selling them.
Stealing. That you're right. That's true. Stealing a person and selling them. Yeah. No.
So by the way, in Hebrew it says, "Vayasuchem b'nei Binyamin," children of Benjamin did so, and they v'yisu nashim lemisparam, they married women to their numbers, min hamecholelot, from the dancers, asher gazalu, that they stole.
Ah, that they stole. I knew it wasn't
gazel,
caught.
A gezel, and there's a difference. There's to steal and there's the gzol. And gezel is usually something that's done in the open. Usually it's explained that ganav.
Because there's a bride price, right? There's a bride price for...
There's a bride price. So you have to pay the father. And the only case is, for example, when we see... but first of all, it doesn't say that they didn't. Because, for example, we have the law that says if someone rapes another betrothed woman, he has to marry her.
Mm-hmm.
So we can claim that that's the same thing. That, you know, first of all, we have to remember what makes marriage, entering into house and consummation of the marriage.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what makes divorce, sending away from the house and obviously giving a document saying you're no longer married.
Mm-hmm.
And here they steal these women. So this is stealing, but out in public. So this is a bit different because there is a subtlety here. So it could be that they stole them and they presumably, quote unquote, raped them, and then they have to marry them as well. So there might have been another loophole that they played with. They raped them. They have to marry them.
Perhaps.
Then it might be another loophole they were playing with.
And it doesn't make the story any better, mind you. But
yeah.
Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and so they rebuilt the cities.
The situation, desperate times call for desperate measures. This is probably what was going through their heads.
Yeah, I suppose so. They dwelt in them. And so the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And Yoel, the final verse, once again, the disclaimer. Do you want to read it for me?
In Hebrew?
Yeah, sure.
So it says here, Bayamim hahem, in those days, en melech b'Yisrael, there is no king in Israel, ish hayashar b'ayinav yaseh, every man does what is right in his own eyes. And then the light. The light is, and there was a man from Ramataim, viewing the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah. So, by the way, why do we have the Book of Samuel suddenly? I understand that the English ones usually have the Book of Ruth here
in between. That's
so,
right.
In between them, so the Hebrew Bible, based on the Aleppo Codex, has the Book of Samuel after the Book of Judges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a different sequence because the Book of Ruth is not a book of prophecy, but on the other hand, it tells a story. You know, storylines very similar. So it tells a story as well. And,
so when is it traditional? I mean, you and I have done for Purim. We did the Book of Esther, obviously. When is it traditional to read the Book of Ruth?
It's usually during Shavuot.
Yeah,
it's understood to be read during Shavuot.
All right, listen. Next Shavuot, we have to do Ruth. Okay.
Okay, we'll do Ruth next Shavuot.
Okay, we'll do that.
We'll do it.
We're finished Judges. We're finished. Thank goodness, the final three chapters. My goodness, Yoel, what a mess. I'm glad we're done with that. Be interested in any comments from the listeners in regards to that debacle. But there are certainly lessons that can be learned, and there's a lot in that. But now we are in the first book of Samuel, Shmuel, and I'm looking forward to getting into this. So this is going to be next week, isn't it? Next week, chapter one. And we're talking about Hannah.
We're talking about Hannah. We have an interesting prayer there as well. Mm. Interesting story. A lot of little subtleties. I mean, the Book of Samuel, there's a lot of things going on there. I mean, I had a discussion with someone, and they pulled out a few things I never noticed. And I kind of stood there blinking like, wow. Things that, the moment they started developing the puzzle, things started connecting in my head. But there were like interesting things that we discussed. So Book of Samuel, there's a lot of commentary on as well. I have several books that explain the Book of Samuel, which is very interesting.
So we can get out of the rated R and come back to the G rating for the Book of Samuel.
There's a few places where there's a bit of R rating there as well. But you know,
we can relax for a little while.
Yeah, but we can relax for a little while. Yeah. Samuel is a fascinating story. I actually remember learning Judges and Samuel together with the rabbi several years ago, who took a very interesting approach to the books. You know, I remember when we finished Judges, he said, and now that's why I said the light in the end of the tunnel. That was something that he said to us. And now the light at the end of the tunnel, the Book of Samuel, when finally someone's saying, organize this nation. And so it's a very interesting thing. But there's a lot of there's a element of politics going on in the story. Remember, I mentioned about the tribe of Benjamin. That it could be one of the reasons for the end of the story is a bit of criticism about Saul and his tribe and why they're unworthy to be kings. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interesting things here about the development of the people of Israel.
That's another thing, by the way, that Shaul, Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin.
From the tribe of Benjamin, yeah.
So isn't that interesting that the tribe of Benjamin saved the so there's another parallel for 1 Samuel 11.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, not a parallel, but there's a connection there. There's a connection.
There's someone from the tribe of Benjamin saves the people of Yavesh Gilad, and the people of Yavesh Gilad were killed to save the children of Benjamin.
Benjamin.
So there's a lot of these interesting connections and stuff like that. So really, you know, it goes back to what you said, that you know, God struck down or diminished a tribe from the people of Israel. There's always an understanding that there's these like cycles in the world. Someone does something, it's called the butterfly effect. Someone does something and then it revolves into something else and revolves into something else, and then suddenly it returns in a certain way. And there's actually there's a thing in the Bible basically deals with the issue of, like I said, a knife and eye, tooth for tooth, but not necessarily just in that element, but sometimes in the issue of someone does something so he gets repaid in a certain way, but someone that's connected to him in another way, and then it's like
and
a ping pong there
scheme,
between certain.
Yeah,
there's ping pongs in between specific characters because there's some kind of a connection in between them. And we're going to have a lot of fun with Samuel, I think, because there's a lot of that going on there.
We've finally returned to the light of the prophets, with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Thank you, my friend, for helping us get through the final chapter of Judges. I'm glad we're done with that one. Looking forward to Samuel next week. Again, his Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. Hebrew in Israel. Like the page. Get involved. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, dear listener, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter U, .org. Next week, Samuel chapter one. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.